Welcome, movie fans, here on Anatomy of Movie on Popcorn Talk. We're dissecting a movie about the Amazon, released by Amazon. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of Anatomy of Movie. A movie that we've been wanting to do for quite a bit, but unfortunately, we had to wait until it had a bigger release, so I'm happy for that. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And not out of the States, I guess. He's in Hawaii, so he's in the States, but out of the continental U.S., Dimitri Panos is not here, so instead, you've seen her once or twice, or a couple of times, certainly, here. The last movie you did was BFG, correct? Am I wrong?
I know. I can't remember now. I've done a few.
Oh, we have
there.
Carolyn Faraday.
Anyway, hello. I didn't realize I was representing Dimitri today. I feel like there's
Well, you're representing you.
Big movie
He's
shoes
just
to
gone.
Film.
Yeah.
But thank you. Hello.
We did Nocturnal Animals together.
I think we did do Nocturnal Animals. We excluded you from that.
Yeah. I see. There
yeah, we were like, nah, he's got nothing for us on that one.
That was the girl show on that.
Yeah.
One.
Well, I'm excited to talk about this movie, The Lost City of Z. You know, historical piece based on a nonfiction book that we'll sort of go into. But as we always do, a couple of things. Number one, if you're a first-time listener, it is going to be spoiler-filled. So if you don't mind, then pay attention. If you do mind, stop us, go see the movie, then come back to us. Secondly, we'll post our notes as part of the description. You can download them so that way you guys can follow along with all of our research. As we always do, let's start with overall impressions. And I always say females first. Usually it goes to Marissa, but I'll kick it off to you. Since,
oh, my goodness.
Sort of, not newer to the panel, but...
Since I'm representing Dimitri now.
Back from hiatus.
Since I'm available. I, first of all, feel this urge to call it the Lost City of Zed quite a lot, obviously, because we say Z differently to you. But you know, that's my early call. It's kind of bladder busting, this movie.
Bladder busting.
It's a bladder buster. It's an exceptionally long movie, and if you can make it out of that movie theater and it just be a one wee film, then I'm amazed at your bladder. That's all I would say. Like, okay. it was an exceptional bladder buster. Overall, I enjoyed it. I'm about the kind of, I don't know, I'm a tough marker. 7.5 out of 10. Like, there's so much I liked about this kind of swashbuckling adventurer. Mm-hmm. And then there were parts I found a little repetitive, which I guess, like, I'll just repeat later and almost be like Groundhog Day. So it's sort of the Lost City of Z meets Groundhog Day a couple of times. But, I mean, overall, I thought it was an absolute delight and lovely performances throughout. And a really nice lead man turn from Charlie Hunnam, like, you know, unexpectedly in many ways. Like, you know, a new person to have as, like, carrying a film on that scale. And he's a Brit. He started out on a show called Bite a Grove, which is like a teen, like a kid's, like, it would be on at, like, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, post-school, oh, wow, like a soap opera. And a lot of young actors started out there. And it's something that, like, they either start out in and then they eventually work in a bank. And then everyone's like, hey, did you know George in Accounts used to be on Biker Grove? Or they do, like, really well. Mm-hmm. So Biker Grove, which is set in Newcastle, hence the Biker Grove. Because he's a strong... Yeah, he's a Newcastle boy, so... normally, like, yeah, so he's done super well.
I love having a Brit on the panel.
So you're like, I don't know what she said, but she said
I'm still stuck at Bladderbuster.
Bladderbuster.
Marissa, what about you?
This will be a fun show. I'm excited. I enjoyed this movie more than I thought I was going to be, because I went in knowing it was about, like, this exploration of the jungle, but I'm like, how are they going to show it? And I thought visually it looked beautiful. And I think the pacing could have, like, picked it up a little bit. But I think, you know, back in that time, back in 1919s, you know, that's that's when people's attention span lasted more than 2 hours. So, yeah, I can understand that. Visually, I thought it was beautiful. I thought the acting and performances, which we'll get into, were great from everybody. And, like, I felt like they all had good, strong moments. And Charlie Hunnam, who is an actor who I personally don't really care for, I really liked him in this film. So, overall, I didn't really know anything about The Lost City of Z. And now, walking out of the film, I was like, oh, I'm kind of interested in, you know, this past civilization of what happened back then, and kind of wanted to learn more about it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the movie overall, and even though I'm going to kind of lay out a couple knocks against it, overall I really did enjoy it, and I thought it had a lot of stuff to offer and was done really well. But I think in a world where we have, you know, The Mummy and various action movies of that nature with, you know, Indiana Jones, I think, you know, it suffered because of that pacing, right? Furthermore, I felt it, you know, in hindsight, it had a lot to juggle. It had his obsession, it had the politics of the various things. And then if the whole sort of point at the end was not redemption, but coming to terms with Jack and him, Percy, you know, and them venturing out, I felt, you know, they were also trying to juggle family, and perhaps by trying to do all three, maybe just one suffered just because they, you know, they had to split it just by that sheer nature. And I think the biggest knock, and unfortunately this is history, but we never get to really see the city. Right? Like, if I'm watching a movie called The Lost City of Z, again, I understand it. You can't really rewrite history, but you're in some sense expecting to see something.
It does stay lost. And you do expect in movie land to finally get there, don't you? I mean, that's what we're all expecting, is at the end to have this final reveal, and he's, you know, vindicated, you know, in all of his belief, and then so then you're left with this moment going,
sure. You're left with the letter, you know, leading to believe that you have to believe him, that he made it. You're like, oh, I guess he did.
The compass. And then that's it. The compass.
It's just like the acceptance of, even though we don't see it, you have to accept it, that it was actually true.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, it's got a lot of great reviews from critics, but I'm surprised in that sense because, yeah, as you pointed out, like, in movie land, that's the expectation that we've come to see. Like, we want to see the Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark. We want to see the...
It'd be like Lord of the Rings, and they never get there. Just be like, the ring.
Well, even worse, the fact that they never even had the ring. As if they just talked about the ring for hours on end and never...
Just never quite get there. So, yeah, I mean, but like you say, it's a true story, and no, and there were all sorts of parts, obviously, that you fictionalize in that situation anyway. I think he actually, God, I was there by the time he kind of went on his final trip. I was like, yeah, yada yada yada, let's just get it, let's have a montage sequence now. And but I think he went something like 23 times, and like in the movie he goes three or four times or something, and then you're like, yeah, okay, he's off again. But like in real life, I mean, it'd be great if you were just like there 5 days later going, I don't know, it's like the 18th time.
This is a hypothetical, but Darren Aronofsky does movies for me really well in terms of a man obsessed. And this, to me, is a movie about a man obsessed. Mm. And I think fantastic job by James Gray. Don't mean to knock him, and we'll talk about all the good stuff. But do you think Darren Aronofsky would have gone sort of more that route of just finding you know, Percy's obsession and being able to execute?
I felt like his obsession was really well represented in there, and that I felt very engaged in that, and on board with kind of understanding the man that he was and what drove him and what kept him going with that, and also that you've then got to anchor that with, like, he, you know, also being a family man and not totally being selfish with it, because you've got to like him. It's hard to watch someone do something that's so exceptionally selfish in terms of his family life, and did cause problems with his son, and yet still really, really like that character and understand his choices. And I think they trod that line exceptionally well. And I know James Gray was sort of saying, I don't know why they sent me this script. I wasn't the man for the job. What in my background made you think I was? So I think he was as surprised as anyone. But I didn't feel that was missed. Whether Darren Aronofsky, I'm sure he would have had a different vision and told it a different way. Would it have been better?
Sure, yeah, it would have been different. Let's take a quick step back. Marissa, give us, because much like them trying to find the lost city of Z, they've been trying to find a way to make this movie for quite some time.
Yeah, it was interesting. The development took a long time for this film. So James Gray actually got the unpublished version of the book before it was even published yet, back in 2008, and the book was published in 2009. So he got an early, you know, draft of just the book and the story, and he read it, and he thought it was really interesting. And the funny thing is, like, the developers, Brad Pitt, also, was one of the people who sent this book to him. And James Gray read the story, and he was immediately enthralled, and he's like, yeah, I have to put this in motion. But during development, things change and stuff, and they had different actors. Originally, you know, part of this, it was first supposed to be Brad Pitt, and then he fell out, and then it was going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. But his wife got pregnant and didn't work up with the scheduling, because around the time where his wife would have had the baby, he would have been in the middle of the Amazon forest. So he's like, I can't do it. So, and that just, like, messed a lot of the scheduling. And so they had to, like, recast, and they finally got Charlie Hunnam on board.
It's interesting because you do spend a good part of that film thinking, I can see Brad Pitt in this role. And obviously he had the producer role, but Brad Pitt from 20 years ago, like, he's too old to play that role now, in my humble opinion. You'd have to Benjamin Button the hell out of him, because you need someone who you believe is sort of young and
adventurous
enough, like, to kind of go out there and
Troy Brad Pitt could have done it.
Right, yeah. It definitely needs to be.
There you go.
It needs to be Brad Pitt, but the old Brad Pitt. Cumberbatch, I think, would have been a charming choice for that role. Like, I could really see him playing that role, like, a billion percent.
Mm-hmm.
Just think he would have just been a superb choice. Clearly was a superb choice. But, I mean, I would watch him stand still for 2 hours.
Oh, for
sure.
To be
honest with you. Like, and he'd still be the most charismatic thing happening. He's just fabulous at everything he does, isn't he? So, but I could really see him in that very... I'd love to see him take on that board of fuddy duddies in the movie, and kind of go in there and do that. I wonder if he'd be slightly too posh, because you sort of think he's quite establishment Benedict Cumberbatch. That's the only thing I would say. Like, Charlie Hunnam's just, like, a little bit more edgy and a little bit more of a beefcake than your Cumberbatch.
Stuckier build.
Yeah, whereas, like, Cumberbatch is, you know, he's very posh.
Very posh. I think ultimately casting actually ended up playing well. I mean, I could see Pitt. I could see Benedict a little bit less so. Like, my ranking is Pitt, then Charlie, then Cumberbatch, in terms of who probably could have done it best. But in terms of that, one of the aspects of the movie that I really enjoyed was the fact that we were, like, there's so many World War II era movies.
World War One.
I'm saying that's what I enjoyed about it, was the fact that we sort of go before. Because everyone's sort of, you know, for whatever reason, everyone just fascinates over World War II in that era, whereas you forget, like, there's a lot of great stuff within just this time span itself.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed that side of it, and seeing the politics at that time. You know, they made several references to, like, the Archduke Ferdinand, which obviously many attribute to the start of the Great War and so forth, but I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, and you also saw some of the politics back then, even more so, and you saw how things have changed since when in the courtroom where there was the moment where, like, that's my husband, I should be down there, and you're like, men allowed. I'm like, in today's society, you probably would let women down there, you know, with your husband. So yeah, I liked how I felt like they covered the time period very well, even down to the wardrobe and, you know, the customs back then.
Yeah, I like a good World War One movie generally, because it's not as technologically advanced. Mm-hmm. So it's very much like on the man and on the character of the man, and there was this kind of noble, I'm going to go and fight for my guy. I mean, and mm-hmm. it was such a savage, awful, terrible war, like I know what war is, so how do you say, oh, this one was worse? But I mean, like, it was there was so much just senseless running into, you know, and blooded fields. Like, it was a really raw way of fighting a war, whereas, you know, look at now, where they're fought out of mm-hmm. containers in the middle of the desert by drones. Like, it's times have changed.
Yeah, that's for sure. I want to go to the notion that I found sort of fascinating and that really sort of kicked it off. And in terms of the motive of Percy, it started with the idea of getting rank, right? And that was really his driving force in a lot of this. And, you know, I like that notion, because then Jack, in some sense, throws that back in Percy's face and says, like, you're a failure. And then the two of them doing it together, he finally accomplishes, you know, he gets the royal...
the thing.
He gets the main medal, right? So it was a nice sentiment in that way. And to me, it really showed, like, that's not really what he was truly after. And I was trying to figure out, okay, well, what was his motive? So I want to get from your perspective, like, how you felt that was used, and did his motive change throughout, or was it always just different, even though he said it was one thing?
I think the motive changed throughout. I mean, you saw the first one, which just happened, you know, coincidentally, where he thought he found something. The second one, he was, like, really motivated to go. And then the third, it was more so the family convinced him to go, because he was already, like, mentally done. He's like, you know, that's when I was younger, that was fine. But it was his son and his wife that, like, encouraged him to go once again, just to, you know, for that self-fulfillment. So, yeah, I think his character and motives changed throughout every single time he went to the jungle.
I feel like you got that need for him to do something honorable, and obviously you get that flash of his family's past. His father was a drunk, and, you know, he fought against this guy ruining the family name, and he wants to redeem it. And so you've got that battle that he sort of wants to redeem his family name and have this honorable journey and kind of honorable process. What I really think comes through and is so charming throughout the movie is his total integrity, like, with what he does, with his treatment towards his family and his treatment towards the fellow men on his expedition. Like, he has total integrity when he goes in to the Royal Geographic Society, when he goes in there, that he's still has total integrity when he's in that difficult moment with Murray. And, you know, just those moments of total integrity where he will not compromise on the welfare of the people around him and of the truth of the situation. And I think that really makes you get behind him and behind his quest. Mm-hmm. And it also makes you really believe in his quest. It makes you believe, like, if he's got integrity about all of these other things, then you believe in his lost city of Z.
Yeah, and to that, I think they pulled that off wonderfully, because obviously in many other instances you could be like, well, it could have become self-sabotage. Well, he wants to save these people, so that way it gives him an excuse not to have found the city. Which, you're right, I don't think he ever does that with that intention in terms of self-sabotage.
And that you see Murray being hoisted by his own petard, when you see someone there that is going a different way and saying, hey, don't do it that way, I'm more traditional, and he's got this more traditional approach, that you see that someone else couldn't have done it and didn't do it and couldn't kind of do that journey and didn't have that same integrity and was, I mean, yeah, was hoisted by his own petard.
Absolutely.
I've got hoisted by his own petard and Bladder Buster on today's show. I feel like I should have had some sort of bet before the show about phrases I could get on. I haven't, yeah, by the way, but I would like to say aardvark and armadillo.
This is a silly question, but, you know, worth asking. I mean, is it still sort of, do people still have a sense of judgment based on family history in Britain?
Not like that, no. No, I think that that's a very dated concept, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I would think at that time, your family name and, you know, I could see that being very relevant. Yeah. But obviously, you know, you look through 2017 glasses and say, who does it matter who his dad was? Like, yeah. It sounds ridiculous. But, yeah, I think certainly at that time that would have been reflected.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't speak for all Brits.
Can we
talk about Robert Pattinson?
Sure. Yeah.
Because I was sitting next to a girlfriend of mine when I went to see this, and halfway through the movie, she whispered in my ear, my God, I can't get over how much that guy looks like an old Robert Pattinson. And I went, that is Robert Pattinson. She went, oh, shut up. Like, I mean, the whole time I was like, hey, Robert Pattinson looks really different in this movie, and he's almost unrecognizable. But clearly, yeah, he was completely unrecognizable.
I think he did a great job. And, I recognize him from, you know, his other movies and stuff, but I didn't really see him so much for his acting capabilities more than his looks, which sounds terrible.
No.
But I think he did a really good job in this film because he was that friend and confidant that was, like, truly loyal to...
Yeah, but you were never sure of that early on. You were like, who's this dude? Like, what's his deal?
But, like, I really like that he was that true, loyal friend to Percy throughout all these expeditions. And even at the end, they had, you know, when he was convincing him to try to go once more, he's like, no. But I really liked him, and he added his moments, and I thought he was just really, he was that good confidant that you can, like, take with you.
Yeah, he was like
carry
an anchor.
The film.
Like,
yeah,
he would kind of just be, like, the voice of reason a little bit. You've got this, like, anchor of not going the full crazy. And that friend that just goes, yeah, have you considered?
Right. He was the consistent through line type of friend throughout the film.
And this lovely understated performance, slightly awkward. You're kind of wondering what this odd goofball is doing on this expedition, but it really works as a team, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does, and, you know, it's kind of nice in that way. You had mentioned that he almost took 23 expeditions, you know, as part of the real story. And so, obviously, when you make the movie, you kind of have to pick and choose, okay, well, how are we going to do this, and can we combine certain things? And to a degree, unless, you know, I doubt that you have to do a lot of fair digging, but at the same time, how much digging can you really do in terms of the characters, right, and their dialogue? And so I like that they were able to build this character out, you know, in terms of how historically accurate he is. I'm not sure. But I like that, you know, and I think they combined the best.
Yeah, he needed someone to talk to, didn't he, either way? Like, otherwise you've got, like, Tom Hanks in Castaway kind of going through the jungle. Like, you'd still need someone to talk to. So I don't know whether he was... how real was he?
I don't know.
How real was he?
But even to
Henry Costin.
Your earlier point, I love the fact that the turn towards the end when he does say, like, I'm staying behind. Which obviously shows kind of both their arcs of, well, you know, Percy's come so far, now he's gotten his son to be obsessed with it, which I want to talk about because ultimately I don't think it's the son not being that obsessed. He's just obsessed with reconnecting with his father more than anything.
Yeah, sure.
And then obviously him being like, no, now that I have a family, not a chance in hell I'm going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. And that notion of legacy, I think, with him, and, like, I think that Percy really liked the idea of passing the mantle and kind of passing that on to his son. Although, you know, like, he approached that with caution. Hey, weird, I don't know if you noticed this weird quirk early on, but so Sienna Miller is, like, she's pregnant, isn't she, when he first goes off, right?
She's pregnant every single time.
She's like basically, she's like the most fertile woman who's ever been in a movie. But so she's pregnant, and then when they come back, I think the child is really old, like is about 3, and then but they say that he's only been away for like 9 months. So it's really, I got really confused on the timeline of like how long he'd been away and what was going on, because I was like, huh, like I know how long a baby takes to cook, and like if she knew she was pregnant and starting to say it's got like 6 months, and then like the baby should be like, if he's like 3 months at this stage, it should not be walking around. It really annoyed me. Just saying.
I mean, timeline wise, you know, part of it, I think they did them, they tried to do themselves a service, but I think it could have been a disservice because, you know, the RGS, as I'll call them, they were talking about, like, hey, if you do this, you might never come back. It's going to be years of your life. And then we find out it's not as long as we anticipated.
Yeah, he was like 9 months. By the way, the reason I have to be careful with that, because RGS was the name of my old school.
Oh, really?
And so, like, I keep going to say RGS and thinking, no. Anyway,
well, I think also, yes, there was that line. I remember that. But I think every time he went back, and he was, you know, back in Europe or, you know, wherever he was when he was with his family, I think there was a lot of time jumps within, like when he'd have a meeting with the RGS or if he was in the courtyard or wherever. I think there were like time jumps within, because there were times where There was one scene, like, the kid was, like, say, 3 years old, and then the next scene, he's, like, 5, 7, you know, running around. So I think every time he went back home, there were also time lapses.
Yeah. I just feel like with his expeditions, I wanted to get an idea of particularly that first one, like, how long was he there? Like, I was like, I don't know if this is 2 weeks or, like, 3 months or kind of longer than that. Like, you end up kind of not knowing how long it is. And I think that's, like, an important thing. Like, how long are you away for?
And I think it's also, they would drop multiple lines, like, every time he'd go back to the Amazon, years have passed. Sometimes it'd be 2 years. Sometimes it'd be 3, you know. So I think we can, because they're condensing so much in these 3 expeditions that we see, I think it's just, like, you can assume that
we're like having a time at least nerd.
5 to 7
I want, years. Like, exact timings, and I also want, like, maps. I just want to, I'm like, where exactly on a map is this? And well, can like you just tell me how exactly long this took?
Yeah.
You know? I just wanted more stats.
I think part of the reason they did it was to just showcase the fact that his obsession was ongoing. That is, regardless of time, he was always going to be obsessed with it. And they gave us what they felt like the major beats, but I don't think they wanted to overdo it if they didn't have to.
Sure.
But I want to go back to the notion of Jack choosing to come. Because it seemed like you guys perhaps agreed with me, or at least found it interesting. So what's your guys' perspective on the fact that, you know, Jack wanted to do this?
I think it like carries from the second trip back home to the third trip, you know, going away. Because we saw that slow progression of the son when he's a kid and, like, angry at his father for always being gone, abandonment and all that. But you saw it slowly progress to, like, he's just proud of his father for doing something that he just truly believes in, this mission. And then once he's old and realizes, like, how important it is to even just have, like, a purpose in life, I think that's what he was trying to connect with his father with. Therefore, and I'm glad it built that family connection, because, yeah, you could look at it in a negative way, like, you were always gone, but this is now my time to be with you. So I like the fact that Jack came around, because it didn't seem like Percy always left his family just because he didn't want to. It's like sometimes it's because he needed to.
Yeah, that's why he was an explorer.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting because they had that scene where Sienna Miller says, "Can I come with you?" And he was just like, no. Like, just no. I think that's a bad idea. And that's his general just. And for a moment, I thought, oh my goodness, they're actually going to do this with her going with him. Like, because it was Sienna Miller and she's a name actress, I thought maybe she is going to be in this more and they're going to do that. And I was quite relieved that what happened was quite sensible. But then that's, for a while, I thought, what was that scene about? And then when you see Jack go, you're like, oh, I understand that it's about him not just like gratuitously saying, hey, I want everyone to come with me. Like, it was something that he took very seriously, and he took their safety very seriously, and he took the notion of someone going with him very seriously. You got to feel for Sienna Miller's character that, you know, her husband was gone a lot of their marriage, and then she eventually lost her husband and son to this obsession. Yeah, I mean, you know, like,
but she also egged them on. A man's reach must.
She's very supportive. Yeah, what can you do though? Like but if someone's obsessed like that, like, you can't. That you gotta
don't
do
be
it.
Obsessed.
You was like, you can, I think she was. She truly loved her husband, and like, she truly believed in him. And she was a very progressive woman for that time.
Yeah,
you know, because women back then were way more oppressed than they are now. And I thought she was such a strong, independent woman even back then, but still capable of supporting her husband through all this. I thought she was. She was great to watch. I love Sienna Miller. She's a great actress.
I got
actress.
The feeling with Percy's character that you couldn't have taken that away from him. Like, he was going to go and do that anyway. Mm-hmm. So the choices are support him, facilitate it if you love that man and you love his drive, or not be part of it. Like, those are the only two options that were really available to her. The option wasn't there for her to say, we can have a relationship and you not do this. Like, the options were, I support you through doing this, or we will not be in... You know what I mean? Like, I think it would have meant them not being together, because I think he would have still gone if she'd have put her foot down. What an amazing performance from Tom Holland. He just continues, and he's such an exciting young actor to watch. Yeah. Because, you know, he's come through... obviously landed Spider-Man, and then you think that's such a mainstream role, and then he pulls off things like this where he's just exceptional. And I loved when he got the role in Spider-Man. Robert Downey Jr. was talking about him, because it was it was before Spider-Man, actually. What's the one where he made his first appearance?
Captain America.
He made his, like, first appearance. And Robert Downey Jr. was absolutely raving about what a great actor he is. And he's 19 years old, Tom Holland, and he's
he couldn't grow a mustache.
Yeah, couldn't grow a mustache. I know. Weirdly, it's a slightly show busy story, but I know Tom's dad, I was with him the day that he got Spider-Man. His dad is a stand up comic, and we were doing I was on the same show as him, and he. I know that may sound extraordinary, so given how hilarious I'm not being right now. But he tells this sort of lovely story about his son landing the gig, and, you know, the whole time throughout the whole... Like, firstly, Dominic said to him, hey, I'm the famous one in this family. But he's the youngest of four sons, so he's a very grounded individual from a lovely family. And he landed this role, really, with Dom kind of saying to him the whole time, don't worry, you won't get it. Like, just go to the audition, you won't get it. And he just keeps getting these, like, amazing roles.
I mean, Tom Holland.
He's the real deal.
Yeah, no, he's great, and he's great, and he conducts himself well in every interview I've seen him. The first movie I saw Tom Holland, or, like, really recognized him, was The Impossible, where I, like, bawled my eyes out ridiculously, like, throughout the entire film. And I watched it twice. I don't know why. But he's such a great actor. I mean, that was when he was younger. So, like, to see... I didn't expect him to be in this film.
No, I didn't.
He stood, for being a young guy, but very experienced, he stood very well right next to Charlie Hunnam and stood his own ground and was in the Amazon as well.
So. It's so exciting to watch him and think where his career will be in 5-10 years, because he's just so solid and gracious with it, like, and he's just a joy to have on screen, I think.
Oh, yeah. I agree. He did a fantastic job, and I think Charlie did a great job too of giving him that respect, you know, through his character.
Because Charlie's got a touch of the Tom Hardys. Like, you can't fail to compare those two actors. He's kind of like Tom Hardy, but without the crazy eyes. You're like, Tom Hardy has a darkness to him that Charlie Hunnam doesn't have. But I feel like they're a little bit interchangeable. And, like, sometimes, and I feel sorry for Charlie Hunnam in this, he can almost be slightly a poor man's Tom Hardy. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, we really like Tom Hardy. He's not available. Who you got? Like, we can't afford him. Because he's sort of Tom Hardy, but just without that. I don't know. Tom Hardy's got... He's got a... I don't know. He's got a depth, Tom Hardy, hasn't he? That's freaky.
He's got an interesting... Sometimes when he goes into his accent, that's the most interesting part.
Who, Tom... Which accent?
I'll call it the Revenant accent.
Okay.
Oh, Tom Hardy's...
Yeah.
I need to listen back to that again. Is it Dodge? Is it super dodgy?
I can't describe it. It's just very slow, and it almost sounds like he's got marbles in his mouth. Huh. Here's what... I'm going to leave you for death, you see. I don't know.
Nothing different. Like his Bane voice, that's for sure.
Not at all. Going back to Sienna Miller real fast.
Yeah.
You guys kind of mentioned it, but both James and Sienna worked very closely together to have that full depth. Because one of Sienna's sort of, perturbances or whatever, I'm blanking on the word, but historically she's been a very passive character. Right, female-wise. And so you guys pointed out that she's a strong female character, a very progressive in this time. And that's what they worked towards, was to have it be that way, so that way she didn't just end up being, wallpaper.
This is probably, the nicest, the best, my favorite role that I've seen Sienna Miller do. And, I sometimes find her a little bit meh in stuff. Just a bit.
There's nothing about
just
it.
Just a bit. Well, I know that. Yeah, but we're talking about different things.
Well, I think her character.
She's a beautiful woman, for sure.
I think her character in this film is so likable. There was really nothing that you disliked about this character.
Yeah, I love the spirit.
Every time you see her, you're just rooting for her, and she stood her own ground even when Percy wasn't there. When she addressed herself to her friends and family. When she talked to the man at the end, and, that strong belief that she had in her husband, she was very strong on her own, and she didn't need to stand by a man to shine.
I think, it's such a spirited role and such a great character. And so in some ways I thought perhaps this is the role that Sienna Miller should always... perhaps she hasn't had the roles before that really showcase that side of her as an actor. So
she's great in Burnt.
In which one?
Burnt.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
That's one with Oh my goodness. Bradley
Someone
Cooper.
Else. Oh.
Bradley
Cooper. Oh, okay. Yeah.
One.
Isn't that rubbish though?
The movie was okay. But her performance was great.
That's
Go see Burt. She was great in that.
Okay.
Well, I definitely want to talk about the ending. But what was your guys' favorite speech from Percy throughout? Because he had so many, right, that you guys already pointed out a couple of them. But even when he's addressing the men right before battle during the Great War, before his eyesight goes away and then comes back and all that. He's got so many of these great moments. Which one stood out to you the most?
I think for me personally was after he came back after the first expedition and he's talking to all the RGS guys. In that courtroom, when he had that loud, boisterous voice, and he was so impassioned in that speech, it was saying "I have found the lost city of Zed. I just need to go back," and all that. I was like, "Wow, what a performance!" Because he's addressing everyone, and people are mocking him at this time, and he's just soaking it in, laughing. And but to stand that ground and have such a great, compelling, enthusiastic speech to
super
go
dynamic.
Back.
Yeah.
Because you saw the progression of even the men in that courtroom. They were so doubtful and against him. And then at the end of his speech, they were all clapping and cheering him on for his next expedition. I was like, that was a great performance to listen to watch.
Yeah,
to have
persuasive.
A whole courtroom change their opinion. Whoa.
Yeah, there's a great career for him in law, I think. If he wasn't an explorer, he'd be
he could be a great litigator.
He'd be great in Legally Blonde. Just turn in the courtroom.
Unfortunately, I don't think he knows anything about perms.
I love that mixture of, I mentioned the integrity earlier, and I mentioned this moment earlier where he is addressing the RGS so fearlessly, where he's dealing with that Murray situation, and then he comes back with a great punch of I'll apologize, and you're like, what? Don't, and then he goes, for La La La, you know, like a goes off one. Yeah, exactly. And sort of won't let those people down. I just thought that was a lovely moment of courage and integrity. And it also was dealt with like a neat amount of humour. Like that there was a warmth to that. And there was that great irreverence towards this real establishment, and he stuck, as we do in the UK, two fingers up at them, and just and sort of was like, "Screw you! Like, this is not going to be that way, and I'm not going to play your game."
But he did it so respectful too, because it didn't get to the point where he was cursing or just irreverent. He was like, "And I officially resign. Good day to you, sir." Yeah. And then he walked out.
Yeah, it's very dignified.
Like, if I was put in the same situation, I'd do the exact same thing he did.
Yeah.
I think he handled it well.
Excellent. Well, I do want to talk about the ending, but before we talk about the ending,
yes,
I think something that could have helped these explorers would have been Blue Apron. You see, Blue Apron is a food delivery service. Wouldn't that have been fantastic?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. They needed it on that canoe.
Especially when they lost all their rations. Like, what food did they have?
Imagine just coming in and be like, we
exactly
got it.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See? You get not only do you get food, it's fresh food. So definitely could have helped them.
It would have really helped. They'd have never needed that dead pig.
They wouldn't have had to hunt, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Blue Apron is our sponsor for this show. We appreciate them. We support them. And
those cannibals in the jungle, they benefit from it as well. No more eating human remains.
That's right. Blue Apron, speaking of their freshness, they have partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the U.S., and therefore everything you get is so fresh. Everything's 99% within the continental U.S. And so, okay, what is it really? Well, the nice part is, as I mentioned, they deliver ingredients right to your doorstep. And what they do, one of the great parts is every time you go shopping, you want to make something, you get, you know, X amount of this, X amount of this, and you're left with so much leftovers, and you never know what the hell to do with the leftover. This, you get exactly what you need. You get a nice little recipe card, and you're able to make it. Speaking of, we've been talking a lot about family. What better to bond a family than cooking?
Sure.
Very
right?
True.
Statistics show that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. So you're healthier, you're stronger as a family, and guess what? All this is less than $10 per person for every delicious meal. So you think going out is costly or can be cheap? Guess what? This can be just as cheap. Also, one of the nice parts is you get to customize it for your dietary needs. Are you vegetarian? You can have that. Do you like pork? Do you like chicken? Do you like beef? All these various things come into play. You get to select what you ultimately want. Some featured meals for this month, we've got beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice. We've got baked spinach and egg flatbread with sauteed asparagus and lemon.
Yeah. Sounds good.
This one might be for
I'm
you.
In for
three
that.
Cheese, and Marissa loves her cheese.
I love cheese.
And baby broccoli with tomato. You don't love tomato, but
what do you
oregano
do with a pizza? Like, what do you do? You don't have you
she
don't
just
have
hates,
the
like, tomato,
but you have
yeah.
the cheese.
I don't like the tomato-ish.
So once again, it's affordable. There's a variety in foods. It's flexible. It's obviously very easy. And you're guaranteed
Charlie Hummond would have liked it in the jungle.
He mm-hmm. would. Now, mm-hmm. here's the kicker, right? So we've talked about how great they are. Here's what is in it really for you as our listeners. You can get three meals for free.
What?
If you use the promo code blueapron.com/anatomy. So the promo code is anatomy. You get three free meals that includes
slightly
free shipping.
It's slightly unfortunate that's the promo code after that, isn't it?
Why is that?
I don't know if I want to be eating any anatomy.
Well, that's the name
because
of our show.
Of anatomy, you
but
get to
we
eat.
Mean anatomy of a movie.
So yes. There you go. Blue Apron, a better way to cook, certainly would have helped our explorers.
Yeah, I would have done. They could have done with that. I would have loved it if, like, Blue Apron had just calmed down the river, got their canoe like this. Hey, local cannibals, got it.
Well, thanks to Amazon's drones.
It's my noodles.
It might just drop on in there. Why not?
Oh, yeah.
Today's day and age we're living in. Who knows?
True.
Yeah, they would find it in no time. They'd have lovely supplies.
Thanks, Blue Apron.
All right. But
I did... I'm just going to tell a story about me, because why not? And but the Lost City of Z, I did the Machu Picchu, and you do the trail.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and they have these amazing porters who carry everything. It's just like a 4-day-long trek. And the food they would knock up in the middle of nowhere that they've had to be, like, carrying for days. Someone had a birthday about 2 days in, and they cooked the most amazing cake. Well, I was like, where are you baking this? Like, there's obviously no electricity.
Blue Apron.
Like, they knocked up this amazing birthday cake for this most amazing food. Anyway, and they did it all in flip-flops. I mean, like, trekking along this thing, you're like, flip-flops.
I was interested in going, how did you book it?
Okay. Well, there you go. All right. Machu Picchu sounds awesome.
Yeah, do it. Yeah. Anyway, it was once kind of like the Lost City of Z. Like, a lot of that reminded me of doing that trek. I think that's why I liked the movie so much. I was like, this is like being there.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about the ending, because I found it, obviously they get kidnapped by the natives there. But there's something, you know, there's that line that says, you know, we need to kind of let their spirits be, or fuse their spirits. I forget the exact line, but it's about spirits. And I found it very interesting. And again, we're never really left with any conclusion apart from their taking away to what we feel like is their death. I feel like is their death.
Sure.
Yeah.
And also, that's guesswork. Like, that whole part... of were they captured by natives? Were they in this situation? Were they drugged and then eaten? Like, I feel like that's a reasonable conclusion given the evidence they've got. You know, there's no bones, there's no, like, you know, like, you're like, oh, I imagine he's soup. But there's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of guesswork. That final scene is guesswork. Or it's not the final scene, but their final moments are guesswork. And I suppose you're comforted by the notion that they were together. Like, I was like, what would you do in that situation? You can't run. Like, where would you go? You'd get a spear in your back. So you can't really run from it. And then they kind of give them that potion, and I'd be like, yeah, I think at that point you're just like, give me the drugs, whatevs. Gonna pee-pee nine eyes now. And amen.
I think there was that line that, like, I didn't really, I mean, I was afraid for their life, but at the end when they were being carried off in, like, a sacrificial way, I didn't really think that they were going to kill them, because there was the particular line that Percy says, like, whatever happens isn't our fate. And I was like, well, his fate is to find this place, so he has to find it. But, like, I thought it was beautiful, though. I
thought that was him just comforting his son and say, like, because he was trying to be the father in that situation and be like, don't panic. And I bet, like, inside he was like,
it's like, oh, great,
my destiny
die.
Sucks.
Like, he's just like, Jess, it's your destiny, son. Don't worry.
Like, it's my third time back.
I bet he was like, Sienna's gonna kill me.
Yeah. I wanted to know, like, what comfort do you take from that moment as a viewer?
I found it slightly dissatisfactory, to be honest with you. But, I mean, also a fairly decent guess at what went on. You know, like, there was a mystery, really. Like, so what happened to him? Why didn't they come back? Did they find it? At what point did they get killed? Maybe they just starved to death. Like, you don't know what happened. It feels like a reasonable... Like, if you keep taking exceptional risk, like, the risk to you increases.
Right. Well, I think it's also, like, they kind of left it ambiguous and open-ended for the audience, because we really don't know what happened back in Lost City of Z. So I think it left all the same questions that we were... we still have, you know.
From the compass.
They left it up to the imagination that it's like, oh, this is what probably happened. But I think that's what's the fun part of the movie magic. As a watcher who watched a 2.5 hour long movie, you're like, can we at least see it? Yeah, I think that part is the satisfactory. But having the comfort of seeing the like you said, the compass, like, okay, I guess they did make it. So in a way, I was satisfied.
Part of me wanted an atonement ending.
Sure.
And sorry, guys, if you don't want to hear the spoiler of Atonement, tune out for like the next minute. Where at least like, okay, what happened in actuality is not that happy, but maybe Sienna Miller, she could have like made up some story and was like, this is what happened. Here's the compass. They made it. Woohoo! And we see like a glimpse of them like running up the steps to the city.
But she believed that. I think she believed that. And I can't think of anything in life that's more frustrating than losing someone that you love and not getting that moment of knowing what happened and not getting a moment of burial where you get to say goodbye and have that conclusion where it's just open-ended. Like, at what point do you call it? A week or a month or a year or 10 years down the line? At what point do you
certainly
decide
when you yourself
that you're done?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, then, obviously, then she stopped looking.
Yes.
Thanks. Hey, then she dies. imagine searching, like, not knowing until the day that you die. Like,
mm-hmm.
And her son, too. Not just a husband and son.
Yeah, it's like the family is left behind.
Well, that's why that line from Percy to the younger son, when he says, like, hey, you've got an equal mission, if not more important, you're the man now. Yeah, he is. He's the only man.
He also had no experience to go into there, like, none at all. And, like, so essentially it was like an enormous babysitting trip. But I think Percy had this such like this extraordinary belief that he was invincible, and that eventually is going to, in those circumstances, you know, that's all very well and good, but the reality of the situation is a very hostile territory.
Well, did he? I mean, I feel like part of him, you know, he tried to put on a brave face to the public, but the fact that it was just him and his son, he was kind of like, nobody wants to join me.
Yeah, because but he still had that invincibility then. Like, he had it early on as a younger man. He had it, excuse me, when he was in... I'm going to cough now. He had it when he was in with the RGS. He had it when he was giving that speech at the front of the RGS. Like, the whole time is this total belief of his invincibility. Like, they're like, I'm the man that can do this. And yeah, that gets you a long way. Look at Donald Trump. It gets you a long way, that, like, that kind of extreme self-belief.
Right, and you know, we talked about it, you know, the different motivations. The second time, he went there to prove a point.
Sure.
And then the third time is because the family encouraged him. The third time was literally just out of his own passion. So it's not like, it would have been beneficial if more people joined him, but it was more his self-fulfilling, selfish reasons why he wanted to go the third time.
Well, I guess here's how, like, if I want to go to Mount Everest, I can do it. And my passion is great. However, I still probably need a few people around me.
And also, when people go to Mount Everest, they basically just do base camp. They don't go to the peak. So it's kind of like watching a movie called Let's Climb Mount Everest and then just watching them get to base camp and being like, okay.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we did Anatomy for Everest, the movie.
Not the ride.
Not the ride.
Let's do an Anatomy for the ride.
All right, why don't we shift gears and go into the production side of things? And one of my favorite sort of nuggets is the fact that James Gray wrote the Francis Ford Coppola and asked him for advice on shooting in the jungle, because obviously Coppola did Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
He got a 2-word response, don't go.
That's amazing.
Obviously, he didn't take the advice.
No.
Which, by the way, apparently neither did Coppola, because he got that same advice from Roger Corman when Coppola was set to go into the jungle.
It sounds like James Gray was really hands-on, and he cooked pasta every night for the cast and crew. I guess it must have helped maybe not for the, maybe the cast weren't so thrilled, but for the sorry, maybe the crew weren't so thrilled, but for the cast to kind of feel in the moment and feel the character, to have an element of kind of risk and hardship while they were filming, to kind of stay in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give the cast and crew props for filming in such, you know, difficult terrain, because I was listening to a bunch of their interviews and they said how difficult of a shoot it was, like physically grueling it was. They're, because they filmed in the middle of rain season, it would rain every single day at a certain time. They're like to the point where like clockwork at 3:30 it would just start downpouring rain. But there was a shoot. There was a night where it just like downpoured for hours and the river would just rise like by feet just a few minutes and stuff. So because the river was going, you know, it was rising, the water was rushing so fast that they couldn't even get onto the boats to go down the river. It was too dangerous. They had to trek all their luggage for 3 hours back to where they were staying, the location. So it was like difficult filming for them. And even when the water was, you know, really high, they were dealing with black caiman alligators, or no, they're actually crocodiles, sorry. But it was just, they're literally,
you're so cute. So cute.
They're literally surrounded by their environment. They're like, black caimans are actually more vicious than crocodiles. They're a more vicious version of crocodiles. And then even Charlie Hunnam got a beetle crawled into his ear and bit his eardrum. It was a difficult shoot for everybody, but they did it.
It's like they were in like
Revenant or Lost of the UFC.
I was thinking just like Revenant, like it's, you know, the similar kind of difficulties of, you know, that's an easy, it's a good comparison to make of like the
right
punishing outdoor elements affecting a thing.
Suffer for your art.
It's interesting that they because they recreated the Battle of the Somme, and then I didn't realize that they did that like just outside Belfast in Ireland, which I guess, you know, it's quite a traumatic and difficult thing to try and recreate, and I was surprised by that, but I guess nice lush
they gotta
green.
Shoot it somewhere.
Yeah, maybe they could have just shot it in the Somme.
Who knows. Overall quick shoot schedule, 55 days.
Yeah, well, would you want to stay in the jungle any longer? Like, I don't blame them.
Do you know the boat captain got malaria and two people in the AD department got dengue?
Yeah. I mean, they were literally in the Amazon. It's not the easiest place to be in. So I applaud all of them, you know, risking their health and their well-being to be down there to film this movie.
They get well rewarded.
Yeah.
Well, again, I mean, it's different than The Revenant. Like, The Revenant, come on. I mean, it got so much praise, where I really want that for this movie. But
yeah, they knew they were gunning for an Oscar with doing The Revenant. Whereas this, they're like, we're gunning to get it in a movie theater.
Yeah, so I think it's doing well and things like that. But yeah, I don't...
I feel a bit...
I don't know.
I mean, because this has got really nice reviews from critics. And, like, it's a film I think we all enjoyed, but I feel like it's a film, like, if you were chatting with your friends and said, have you seen Lost City and Z, like, it's not getting that recognition, and it's not, I don't know what it is about that, and like, is it the name, is it the lead, like, why does it feel a bit off radar?
I mean, in fairness, if you're going to make comparisons to the Revenant, that was like actually released during Oscar season. It had Leonardo DiCaprio. They were gunning for those Academy Awards, where this one's released in April, and April, May of 2017. It's not in that Oscar time. A lot of people aren't watching this type of movie for that type of buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. You know, I don't think it has the same marketing around it. I mean, just the fact that, like, I mean, with The Revenant, you could just be like, hey, look what Leonardo DiCaprio puts himself through. Whereas this, like, you could say the same thing, but they're not advertising it that way. I think it's just, you know, it's not that The Revenant was a familiar story, but it's sort of a standalone piece. And in this sense, like, no one really necessarily knows the history. And again, it's tough to market, because if you're, like, even in the trailer, maybe it would be great, like, you kind of expect that moment where you find the Lost City of Z, but you cut in the trailer so you don't actually see it. But again, because the movie doesn't have that moment, you can't even include something like that in the trailer. So I think it's a little bit more difficult to market of what this movie fully is, just because it, you know, it's not The Mummy, it's not Indiana Jones, it's not, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Like, maybe the call it, because I love the name The Lost Cities. Yeah, I think that's a nice, that makes it feel quite classic.
Yeah.
I feel like it's like a classic adventure tale, but it doesn't fully reflect that actually what it is it's a movie about the journey, and it's not about the lost city. Like, it's a, you know, it's a movie about the journey of getting there, but they never get there.
Yeah, I mean, if you, I don't know if it would help them or not, but put on the poster, like, the chase is better than the catch.
Is it, though?
Well, certainly for this, but it better be. You're going to watch a movie because you're never going to catch anything.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, like life's about the journey.
Yeah.
Other bumper stickers that we can do on
half
the
fun
TFZ.
Is getting there.
There you go.
More than half the fun.
And 3 hours of the fun.
3 hours of the fun is just watching them get there and not even saying it. Overall, I liked the look of the film. This film is actually filmed at 35mm, which you wouldn't expect, especially in the jungle. Like, why already put yourself through an added stress level? But apparently they did, at the beginning of filming, they did three different camera test shoots. They used, what was it? I have it here. They used a red camera, and Alexa camera, and then a 35 Kodak camera, and they found, and they did a blind test of what looked better, and they picked the Kodak 35mm. And I believe it was like the producer's like, oh, that's great, but that's going to cost us $50,000 to $70,000 more because it's on film. But they still went with it. And
to be fair, when you're shooting extreme cold or something along this nature where you have just natural elements, I would actually recommend shooting on film, to be honest.
I can see that. But yeah, because of the, you know, the harsh weather and extreme, that also messed with the editing as well, because a lot of times when they got the film reels, because of the high heat intensity, it would destroy a lot of the film that they just shot. So film was an added complication to it, but it looked gorgeous.
Yeah, it does look really good.
I do think digital would have been even worse.
Yeah.
Like, Warren Miller, his movies, his snowboarding and skiing documentaries, like, they're all pretty much still filmed on film because, yeah, try taking anything electronic up to Mount Everest.
With all that humidity, yeah. All that cold. Yeah.
Doesn't work. So...
Hmm.
I think, in the end, a right choice. I actually, like, in terms of the movie, in terms of the ending itself, I thought, yeah, there could have been moments that could have been sped up a little bit, but for the most part, it doesn't have as much fat as you would think for the length that it is.
No, because I feel like when we saw the moments of actual dialogue, it was so compelling and riveting just listening to whoever speaking. So I didn't feel like it dragged on that pace. I felt, like you were saying at the beginning, like, it did get repetitive with the same beats over and over again. It's like, okay, he goes to the jungle. He goes through this. He sees this thing. And now he goes back home with his family. There's the family scene. Now he talks to the RGS. And then you repeat the whole cycle.
Sure, yeah. It's definitely got a touch of the groundhogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it is, like you say, like, I enjoyed all of those scenes. I wasn't there sitting there thinking, what's the purpose of this? But it just is just quite long and repetitive. It's just long.
Yeah.
There's definitely not a ruthless person who's edited this. Like, it's charming and lovely, but I feel like they've left it as their, this is how we want it to look, and not gone, okay, now let's be ruthless and get it down to 90 minutes. Well, like, which you do get some directors are like, my movies are going to be 90 minutes, and that's it. And well, they will really tighten up.
Yeah, the editors, John Axelrod and Lee Hagen, who was the assistant editor on this, there was actually a good interview with them talking about the earlier cuts of this. There was the editor's cut and then their version. Like, the first few cuts were like 4 hours,
sure.
Over like 4 hours long, and then they had to, of course, whittle it down. But we actually have a fun photo that they posted about the editing. They captured it all. Well, they edited it all on Avid, and they were talking about their editing process and all the sound temp songs and sound effects that they threw into it. And usually we don't show this kind of photo during anatomy, but like, Phil, you're an editor, you enjoy editing, and but you can see their the editing process of how. So if you're tuning into iTunes, definitely check out the editing picture on our video. And I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
look at his little eyes light up. Look, slightly dreamier. That's how I look at pictures of Harry Styles.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's got a lot of video tracks, a lot of audio tracks, and things of that nature.
I've never seen you light up like you have now. To be honest with you, not even when you were talking about Sienna Miller earlier. Don't say that.
You can't say that to Sienna.
Do you know what I mean? You know, like in cartoons where their eyes go like little hearts and they just go dreamy.
Put Sienna Miller in the same room as me.
I swear to God, if that picture was next to a picture of Sienna Miller, you'd be like, look at the timeline now. It's so beautiful.
Bring up a picture of Sienna Miller from Layer Cake, you'll see eyes light up.
I bet I won't see that look of total love.
Yeah, but, you know, the interesting is, you know, John Axelrod actually worked with James Gray before in his previous film. So, of course, they already have that working relationship. But the thing is, because I believe it was Axelrod who came in later throughout the editing process, it was the assistant Lee Hagen who had to assemble all the footage together while they were in, you know, when they filmed in Ireland and then the jungle. The assistant had to assemble everything, and then Axelrod actually had to edit it. So
yeah,
I mean, it's a lot of work, especially working with film. That's quite the task.
It is, you know, and you know, typically you kind of pulled this quote, Marissa, too, but the fact that they were, the way they sort of set it up, generally when you edit a movie, you set it up into reels, so you don't actually edit the full movie. You break it down into sort of more usable chunks. And, you know, they had about 7 reels for this, quote unquote.
Yeah,
I do, because it does have that lovely, classic, like, it feels like a really elegant, lovely movie.
Yeah. It does.
I love the color temperature.
The color is absolutely wonderful. The costuming, the style,
sure,
everything. All you know. Just the fact that she's turning off the candles.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because obviously they don't have a light switch. So I found that fun.
Yeah, there's some really charming, lovely moments.
And then picture of Sienna Miller. Damn it.
Time
all times.
So Marissa, you want to talk about the music? You have a lot on the music.
Yeah, so we had Christopher Spellman who composed the music. He recently collaborated with Gray on his last two features, The Immigrant and Two Lovers. And the soundtrack's already out for those who want to listen to it. But Spellman has said about Gray that he has a very specific music that he wants to put into all of his films. And he does so much research ahead of time that they actually didn't put temp music in this movie. So it was all scored afterwards. And then, you know, going a little bit back to the sound design, they purposely put the left, center, right monitors for this film to get the 5.1 sound that you get in this film.
And you know what? I do like that side of it, because what it does tell me also is when you're editing, the fact that the scenes can stand on their own without music. Because everyone one of the first things is, let me lay down some music, and then they start editing to that. And of course, it's going to be better. Because it's got music, and you're like, yeah, this is awesome. But you don't really know until you can watch it without the music and be like, well, this is a piece of shit.
Yeah, you want that compelling moment, whereas, like, am I making a music video?
Yeah.
That's just really long.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounded great, the music, because you definitely got it in the moments where they were, like, going down the river and being attacked by whatever natives that were there. But also, it sounded amazing, too, with, you know, and now learning that they put it in left, center, right to get that full surround sound effect compared to the regular stereo, which is only, you know, two sides. You felt like you were actually in the jungle.
Mm.
That's right.
I don't know, my friend whispering in my ear. Quite love it. It's like that additional moment of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Left, center, right, and left ear. Just behind.
There you go.
So in terms of... One of the interesting parts was that it's been tough to find the budget for this movie, which I imagine... I mean, if I had to guess on a conservative estimate, like, it's probably around $30 million at the least.
I mean, you feel like the stuff in the jungle is going to have been expensive. I don't feel like it's got a high talent spend compared to a lot of movies. So, like, you save a bit there.
Mm-hmm. You do, but yeah, you still... Again, just cost... Like, when you go back into that time period...
I'm just going to ask Brad Pitt. Hold on, I'll call him. Brad, how much did it cost?
But also, you know, just filming on real... film itself is expensive, really, let alone the whole... All the rest of the production design.
Like, trekking all those people through the jungle.
My goodness.
I imagine they didn't do that for free.
No. And think of all the pasta that they had to make.
Right? Well, that's cheap, though, isn't it?
But, you know, I mean, this movie's had quite a build-up. It was at the New York Film Festival. It was at the Berlin Film Festival, the Boston Film Festival. So it's been having this film festival run, and now it's, you know, we, like I said at the top of the show, we were originally going to do it, but they were only showing it in basically two locations within L.A., and now they've expanded far beyond that, and so I hope it continues to expand.
Yeah, it's like a grower, isn't it? Whereas, like, sometimes there's so much anticipation for a movie, and they come in, and everyone, you see it straight away, and you get those big box office opening weekends. Whereas this is like a slow burner.
Yeah,
like people like I kind of hope it will. Like, I think it's a. It's a very nice way to spend an evening watching this movie. Like, it's you your come away evening. Feeling quite, yeah, you're in fact 2 days, but it's, you know, it's a rewarding movie to come away from. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's an interesting tale. Like, I generally love a true life story. Like, that's a thing for me,
right.
And you know, I think you do come away thinking I had a rewarding evening.
You do.
And my bladder hurts. Those are the two things.
Well, luckily for me, I have no problem going to the bathroom.
Well, he's a man.
Don't like to nip out, though, during a movie in case I miss stuff.
I am amazing at knowing what parts are going to be like, okay.
Well, you don't know because you've missed it. And then I kept thinking that the film was about to end as well, because there's a few moments in it where you think, oh, it's all right, they're building up for the end now. And then so I was like, well, it'll just be 5 minutes, surely, because it's been like 2 hours. And then it just sort of doesn't. And even when you're like, oh, he's dying, and then you're like, oh, that's good, like, it'll just be like a little wrap up now. And then you're like, oh, there's like another half an hour.
A bit like, oh, no, he's going to the jungle again. No, we have some time.
I was like, oh, don't do that. I'm absolutely busted, mate. I know you don't need to know about my urinary habits. I've overshared, not for the first time. This is why I don't come on often. Just an oversharer.
I am, like I said, I'm a great predictor of when to go. anyway, 80%, 88% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, obviously,
very high.
Very, very high score there. And by the way, a lot of, like, Hollywood Reporter, a rare piece of contemporary classic cinema, as you've been pointing out. From the rap, Velocity of Z feels like a clear artistic advance for Gray, who proves himself here as one of our finest and most distinctive living filmmakers. So a lot of great.
It's nice that they pointed out that he's living.
Yep.
James Gray, well done on being alive. That review.
Hey, listen, we've had a lot of great directors that aren't alive.
Finally crafty. Well, but they're not making movies currently. Writing for Variety, a film crafted, elegantly shot, sharply sincere movie that's more absorbing than powerful. It is absorbing. I would, like...
Thought-provoking, definitely.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's not a big hitter. It's just a nice, absorbing...
Yeah.
I don't always want to be blown away. Like, I don't always want to come away and be like, oh, like... I'm happy in a comfort zone. Like, it's...
You're comforted that they were just eating at the end of the movie? Yeah.
They were just there.
Yeah, I was really comfortable that they were just eating at the end of the movie. I'm still waiting for them to find it, that's why.
Any final thoughts before we wrap it on up? Marissa, why don't we start with you this
overall
time?
I thought this... It was visually stunning to watch, especially what they go through. And then, you know, learning all the research afterwards, I applaud them. for everything that they went through to pull off such an amazing feat. It's an interesting story that I want to learn more about the Lost City Z. What happened?
And it was the first thing I did when I got back. Yeah, after seeing it, I was like, tell me more about this guy.
It's compelling enough that you can actually believe that this guy was so enthralled to keep going back to figure out more answers. So, like, I understand the appeal to what he was doing. And overall, like, I think it's just a good... Not really fun, but it's an adventurous movie that other people need to know.
Yeah,
I want to go find the city.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go get a couple of burritos in a backpack and hit the road.
Why not?
Group outing. We're off to find the lost city. Is it? Do you think we get insured? It is. Yeah, like everything. What insurance? Where are you going?
Life insurance.
The lost city of Z. Just imagine that. Cool. It is swashbuckling. It is elegant. It is charming. I think, as I said earlier, I think Tom Holland is a charm in it, and just a lovely turn from him. So he's my joy from that, really. And that it's changed how much I like Sienna Miller. Yeah. I didn't dislike her. That sounds like I disliked her. I just felt meh about her.
Okay.
And now I'm like, I loved her. I loved that role. I loved that character. I love a good feisty woman because I'm so low-key and held back myself and repressed.
Really? I could not tell.
I enjoyed the movie, obviously. I enjoyed it a lot. When we go to the Amazon, we'll just say we're going to Brazil. That's how we'll get insured. Just going on vacation, hitting a couple of beaches, maybe seeing some rivers.
Sure.
That type of thing.
I do think it's just the technique of this movie overall, in addition to the story, is just so fantastic. And I applaud it for having the bravery for a movie like this to be made. I applaud Amazon for really getting it out there. And Brad Pitt's plan B to continue making movies. You know, they brought us 12 Years a Slave and tons of other great movies, but... we're just saying, you know what, we're going to make a great movie no matter what.
Yeah, making interesting movies.
Yeah.
Not falling into that trap. Who was I watching? Oh, it was Warren Beatty. I was listening to an interview with Warren Beatty saying, okay, well, why is everything sequels now? Because things like this don't get made now. Like, this is new, it's new talent, like, it's not Lost City of Z2. Like, why is everything sequels? And he was saying, because people have so much choice and that they, before they will set foot in a cinema, they want to know what they're going to get. Which is probably why this is a bit of a slow burner, because there's, like, people need to know what they're going to get. Like, a little bit. And the marketing hasn't been out there, so you're waiting for a friend to be like, I've seen it, you should go.
Yeah,
and then you're like, okay.
Word of mouth.
So anyway, there you go. Just adding a bit of Warren Beatty info. Who was expecting that this show?
Certainly not I. Well, there you have it. We're a raving review from all of us here. Therefore, if you stuck around this long and you haven't seen the movie, go see the frickin' movie.
Yeah, and also, what's wrong with you watching an after show about a movie you haven't seen yet?
You know what? You'd be surprised at our fans. Enough of them do it. Once again, blueapron.com/anatomy will get you 3 free meals to try.
That's free shipping
as well, so you don't have to just go to the Amazon to enjoy this offering. thank you, as always. In the meantime, where can people... correspond with you?
I'm on Twitter at Caroline Faraday. That's with an E and then an A. And on Instagram, it's Caroline_Faraday. I know. What a lot.
There you go.
Marissa?
You can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV.
And follow us here at The Popcorn Talk. Check out our past anatomies. We have so many of them. As I said, just for adventure, we have Everest and tons of other ones, by the way. We've got tons of other great ones coming up. We will be doing Spider-Man Homecoming, so another Tom Holland enjoyable film, and so many others, so definitely check us out. And for me, just go to philsvitek.com. Thank you guys, as always. Please rate, please comment, let us know your opinion. That's what makes this show fun, is when you guys also participate. And we'll be back next time with Guardians of the Galaxy. Bye. Oh, and real fast for Dimitri, we're going to do a watch along for the first Alien. He would hate me if I didn't mention that to people. So, May 16th.
I heard he already hates you.
May 16th is when we're going to do a watch along for the original Alien. So check that out.
I love it. And that's a long movie, too.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.